the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. My name is Brooke Medina, and today I am joined by a special guest co-host, Leah Byers. And Leah and I don't know if we've actually ever podcasted just the two of us together, so welcome and yay!
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really excited.
Oh, I'm glad you're here. Yeah, Ray is out of town this week, and so I asked Leah if she'd be gracious enough to join me, and so we're going to have a discussion where wherein females can monopolize the whole podcast. I kind of like that idea.
Exactly. I've been on here with Ray a few times, but today it's just the women, so you'll get a female perspective on things.
Well, I mean, you know what? It seems apropos given that we are fast approaching the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, so we females get to pontificate on politics this go around together, and I like that.
I like that too.
Hey, so this week what we're going to discuss is a number of topics, but we're going to cover everything from Vice President Biden's potential vice president picks should he win the presidency. We're going to discuss Jeff Bezos, Amazon, the American dream, antitrust, micro schooling and entrepreneurship and education, and alcohol sale restrictions, which Leah and I both have thoughts on. But before we do that, Leah, I know you were recently off. You took some PTO. And so I wanted to ask you, what's it like vacationing during COVID? Give me some of your experiences.
Yeah, so last week I went on a whole week-long vacation. I can't even tell you the last time I took a whole week and went somewhere. But I went to Ocean Isle Beach, which is like southern part of North Carolina coast. And I'd never been there before, so it was a great experience. Shout out to Ocean Isle. It was really nice and calm and, you know, not a lot of like ruckus at night, which I appreciate. And I don't know if part of that was COVID. I do think there was sea turtle hatching going on. We went to walk the beach one evening and they were like set up where the sea turtles were. So that could have been part of it, which was really neat. But yeah, we basically just, because of COVID, you know, we went out to eat a couple times. We had our masks and kind of stayed to ourselves. But other than that, we stayed at the condo the whole week. And, you know, I don't mind that. That was pretty nice in my opinion.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds great. Just to disconnect from the day-to-day rat race. But not only that, but it's in light of just everything that we've all collectively experienced these past several months, I think that a vacation is even more needed. But what were your thoughts on just seeing how the public was vacationing over there? Ocean Isle is more of a relaxed, laid-back area for the most part. So was it vastly different than in Raleigh?
I don't know that I would say vastly different is adequate. Actually, on the beaches itself, you know, obviously people tend to social distance out there anyway. I don't want somebody, you know, sitting right next to me where I have to listen to their music or their conversation when I'm on the beach. So that part of it wasn't too different. One thing is, you know, I like to walk when I go to the beach. I'll just take a walk down, you know, to the nearest pier or whatever. And, you know, in days past, you would stop and pet someone's dog or like have a conversation with someone. But obviously now it's like more friendly to not talk to people, which is kind of, if you're an introvert, you love that. But if you're having a social moment, then you're not going to like that as much. But we went out to eat twice. And one place was, you know, face mask. It was very crowded. People were kind of wary of each other, but then the other place we went, there was hardly any people. So, I guess it just depends on maybe the day or, you know, where people are coming from in town or that kind of thing. But yeah, it was a different experience.
Yeah. You know, so I was recently on the western part of the state. We were camping out there and I just thought, man, this is so, so different than Raleigh. So, I mean, I'm curious to, I don't know where all of our listeners are from. We only know where you guys are tuning into if you're emailing us and kind of giving us an update, but my analytics don't tell me really what counties people are listening from. So curious to hear like where others are listening to our podcast from, but the western part of the state when I was there, it was vastly different in terms of mask wearing was highly more optional than it was here in Raleigh. And yeah, it was in many ways like you didn't even have a virus. So it was just so interesting. I mean, there was still probably about 40 to 50% mask compliance at the Walmart that I was at. But it was just still so different, but so nice to get out into other parts of the state. But let's go ahead and talk about Joe Biden's announcement, his pending announcement of VP picks. And maybe by the time you're listening to this podcast, you might already know who that is. But Leah and I are going to discuss maybe one or two of the folks whose names are being floated. But he's definitely choosing a woman. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what he said, that he is definitely going to pick a woman. And so, you know, I'll be curious to hear your opinion on it. But my opinion as a woman is I would love to see a woman vice president. I'd love to see a woman president. But I don't want a female president just because, or vice president, just because she is a woman. There are plenty of qualified women out there, plenty of women with the leadership skills to get things done. And I want that to be the reason they're picked, not just because they're checking a box. That kind of sat wrong with me when I heard that.
Oh, yeah, I definitely agree with that. I actually tweeted something out about that once he had promised that he would choose a woman. And I just thought, I don't know, I found it a little insulting. I know, even though I totally disagree with him on policy, I'm sure his intentions were good. But as a woman, I want to be chosen to do a job based on what I bring to the table in terms of merits, not my chromosomes. And so that part kind of bothered me. But one of the women's names that is being floated as definitely on the short list is Kamala Harris, which I don't know. I mean, this is kind of interesting because President Trump is very much law and order oriented. Kamala Harris was former DA? Was it former district attorney or actual attorney general of California, maybe?
Some kind of law enforcement. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so high up there, and has a very, very interesting, colorful, possibly problematic record. That might be an understatement when it comes to law enforcement. But do you think she's going to add maybe an element to the Biden campaign that would sort of be a response to Trump's law and order messaging?
Yeah, that certainly could be part of it. I mean, I think, you know, she certainly is a contrast to Joe Biden when it comes to personality. Just from my perception of her, she seems to be more outspoken, obviously more put together than Biden, who seems to kind of crumble at times. So she's certainly more polished than him in that regard. So I think she could bring a lot to the table. And I think she kind of is the front runner, at least like the rumored front runner. But who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Kamala Harris, I don't know how extreme she is when you're like looking at her compared to a Warren, for example, or Bernie Sanders. I think she's a more moderate than them, but that's still not saying much. I mean, if you've watched any of her debates in the past during the primaries, I wasn't necessarily impressed with her. Now, if Tulsi Gabbard was the pick, which is highly unlikely, but if she was, I think that would really sway a lot of moderate center left, maybe even some center right voters for Camp Biden, especially those that are never Trumpers. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I think, you know, Joe Biden is such a disappointing pick to me, and obviously you know, the Democrats chose him and he had been kind of waiting around for a long time. But just with the middle, you know, I think the middle likes some things about Trump, dislikes other things, but I think the Democrats could have put someone up that could have beat Trump, and I'm not sure that Biden is that person. Tulsi Gabbard very well may have been that person, but they the left, and especially like establishment Democrats and the far left, just don't see, they seem to hate her from my perspective. I don't know, but they seem to be very against her, so I'd be surprised. But I think if he did go with someone like that, yeah, that could be a very real threat to Trump, but I don't think his base is going to let him do that.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I mean, Tulsi is far too reasonable. And I mean, even though she has her own issues that, especially like when it comes to her stance on war in Syria, the Assad regime and some of that history, that would be an issue that would inevitably come up during the campaign. But from as far as I know, Hillary Clinton was not a fan, and Hillary Clinton is definitely still part of the establishment that is pulling some strings in the Democratic Party from everything I can tell. Hence, Joe Biden's there. And so, yeah, it'll be interesting to see, but enough of that. We will find out for sure next week, but those are some of our thoughts. But something else I wanted to cover with you, because I was so, I guess, moved. Maybe moved is too strong of a word here, but I just read an opening statement from Jeff Bezos. He is sitting before Congress this week on some antitrust hearings. And of course, as many know, big tech is certainly under fire. It's under a lot of scrutiny. Mark Zuckerberg is no stranger to Capitol Hill. Many of these big tech companies have lobbyists there on a full-time basis there in DC. So there's a lot to untangle there that's under this umbrella of big tech, but just kind of removing ourselves from that element of the big tech discussion and honing in on Jeff Bezos, he shared some of his story of just how he and Amazon came to be what they are today. And I just thought it was moving, and it highlights the beauty of entrepreneurship in America and the ability to achieve the American dream. So something that stood out to me in his story when he was sharing this, which you can find it online anywhere, is he was talking about how his mother had him when she was only 17 years old. She was still in high school. Her high school wasn't going to let her continue to attend and finish out her high school time because she was pregnant. And her father was able to convince them otherwise. She wasn't allowed to walk across the stage, though, because she was pregnant. So she didn't graduate the same that others did. And she went to, she looked for college courses wherein the professor would allow her to bring her baby to school. And he said she would bring two duffel bags each day to college classes. And one would carry all of her books and the other diapers and anything that he might need during the day. And so I just think about the sacrifices she made. And then she ended up marrying a man who later became his adoptive father that was a Cuban immigrant. He fled Cuba during the Castro regime, and so he grew up sort of in this context of, you know, lower income, immigrant family, and now he's a huge success, and Amazon is a huge success, even though Amazon has also faced many, many tumultuous times, especially early on when they were not financially solvent. So I just thought that was a beautiful picture of the American dream at work, regardless of what your thoughts are on Bezos and Bezos' politics. But anyways, do you have any thoughts on any of that?
Yeah, I was really glad when you shared his story with me, because I didn't know those things about him with his mother and his adoptive father. And I thought that was really touching. And, you know, I've seen a lot of my friends on social media that, you know, I knew from college or from back home that I consider to be progressives or left-leaning, but not socialist or anything by any means. But recently, even some of them have been sharing, you know, this is why billionaires shouldn't exist. This is why, you know, Bezos in particular, you know, how much money he makes, all this stuff. But it's like, you know, when you hear about the work that went into it and kind of his beginnings, you know, even within my lifetime, just what he's built to go from that beginning to what he has today, like you said, it's an inspiration. And at the end of the day, like, you know, if Amazon is violating laws related to, you know, workers or anything like that should be dealt with for sure. And they shouldn't be able to abuse the system. But if they're working within the system, you know, to say billionaires shouldn't exist, I think is, you know, what if the world didn't have Amazon? You know, where would we be? Like that, he has reaped a big reward, but he's provided a big service also to society that we all enjoy, you know, until the right. next big thing comes right. along. And so I think you want that innovative spirit, and Bezos is a perfect example of that, in my opinion.
Yeah. Oh, there's so much to say on this, but I mean, there is a uniqueness, that comes with those that are willing to take risks. There's a uniqueness about them. And some of them end up being successful, like Bezos. And I guess for people to hold it against him or others that are wealthy, to hold their wealth against them just for the fact that they are wealthy and automatically assume that it was because of underhanded means, I find just extremely disheartening and concerning, and just I think about the times in America for so long where that was, I mean, I'm not saying this is right, but wealth was looked at as a virtue because it showed a semblance of hard work and a strong ethic, a business acumen, a strong work ethic, resiliency, ability and willingness to take risks, things like that, and also leadership. So these are things that I think we can learn from CEOs and entrepreneurs that are successful. But then, like you mentioned, it also, Jeff Bezos's Amazon employs hundreds of thousands of Americans.
Right.
And so they actually pay $15 an hour. That's their starting pay with benefits, oftentimes with education benefits too. I mean, so to have the federal government, I guess, try to disparage them in some ways when the federal government doesn't even, I guess, you know, take their own job and sort of produce such and yield such good results, I think is a little bit tone deaf, I guess. But anyway, so I'm not saying Jeff Bezos and Amazon are without any sort of blame.
Right.
It'd be interesting to see how those hearings work. But I think that the whole lambasting of entrepreneurship is something that needs to be addressed, and
yeah,
I would say it needs to be pushed away.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, you know, people kind of resist in this day and age the whole narrative of like pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. You know, that's considered to be outdated, although I certainly think there's a lot of merit to that. But, you know, you may have read, or our audience also may have read or heard of this book called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, which kind of digs into like circumstances that also contribute to the success of these people. So it's not just if you work hard, you're going to be the next Jeff Bezos, but that doesn't eliminate his hard work. It just acknowledges that there are these other things that the stars kind of align for certain people, and with him and the internet age, and he tapped into that. And that should be recognized within the circumstances also. And I think people want to put a cap on the sky instead of worrying about, okay, well, how can we, you know, utilize or take advantage of circumstances that come along, or if there are circumstances that are unfair in some way, like how do we rectify those? But you shouldn't punish people that, you know, because that, like we've talked about, that stifles entrepreneurship and innovation. So that's an interesting book, and it doesn't talk about Jeff Bezos, but it talks about, you know, Bill Gates and others that tap into the right thing at the right moment, and, you know, the circumstances of their lives that lead them to have these opportunities. But we should be trying to replicate that for others in our society too, and help us all reach our potential.
Absolutely. And just one more thing on this, it's, America has been for so long a leader in innovation, and you know, it doesn't guarantee success, but it also doesn't bar you from success either. And this is something unique to the United States. I mean, Jeff Bezos even said in his opening statement, this is why people from other countries, I mean, they would give virtually everything to come here for a shot at even just pursuing their dreams, because so many do not have this sort of accessibility that we do. Oftentimes it's because of corrupt crony governments. There's just a lot of bribery at play. One of my friends she's from Ghana, and she talked just about how much bribery happens there in their government. You know, the playing field is very much not level elsewhere. And for all of the left's progressive calls for leveling the playing field, I mean, we've got it so good here in the United States. And I think that too many mix up the words equality, and they are the two meanings of equality. And oftentimes they view equality as meaning equality of outcomes, when in reality it's equality of opportunity. And to your point about Malcolm Gladwell's book, which I haven't read yet, sounds fascinating, doesn't mean we all start from the same point, but we can never, ever, on this side of eternity, you know, completely level that aspect of human experience. Not to mention we humans, you and I both might be given $20 and we might spend it completely differently. Me, I'll probably spend it on Reese's milkshakes at PDQ right around the corner, but I digress. But I mean, it's just, to be human is to have inequalities among ourselves. So inequality is not a great evil. Inequality by the hands of external players such as the government, who have put their thumb on the scale. Now that's wrong, and I'd probably even call that evil, but that's a different conversation. So them's my thoughts.
Right. No, I tend to agree with you on that.
Yeah, but okay, so we're talking about equality of outcome, or not equality of outcome, but equality and equal access to things. What better way to segue into micro schooling? This is something you brought up in our email chain when we were prepping for the podcast, and just entrepreneurship and education, and really what some parents are doing in order to meet the education needs of their kids this go around this fall. So what is micro schooling?
Right. So what kind of sparked this for me, and I saw the term after I read about it. The term wasn't attached to what I originally saw, but I saw this meme being shared by people I'm friends with on social media that are teachers specifically. And it says, okay, teachers, now's your time. You know, you're going to quote unquote homeschool, you know, 10 kids, and you're going to charge them this much per month. And then you're going to have a salary of you know, XYZ amount that's over $100,000 or whatever, and you're only going to have 10 students in your classroom instead of 30, and so it's going to be a better job environment for you. And the irony was not lost on me, although I think the people sharing it, many of them probably did not see the irony that these voices that are promoting this idea of like a small school, one teacher with tuition, are the same people that are against the quote unquote, like privatization of schools. And they say that that's so bad that we want schools to be for profit. We want companies to make money off the schools. You know, that's a bad thing, but that's exactly the scenario that they describe in this meme. And I understand the internet is not real life, but I just thought it was kind of interesting because what if, you know, right now, only kids whose parents could afford to do that could even enroll them in these hypothetical, you know, schools down the road. But what if instead of funding schools, the government were to fund students, teachers would have more opportunity to set up their own schools, you know, and there's probably regulations around private schools. And you can argue what those should or shouldn't be. But the point is, you know, the system right now is not designed for students, is designed for schools. And ultimately, you know, teachers get caught in the middle of that oftentimes. And we're seeing that more than ever in the age of Corona.
I think some interesting analysis and kind of an interesting angle that you took that. And I just love the way you policy analysts think about these things. It's wonderful. But yeah, I mean, I think that there's obviously cognitive dissonance that's going on here when it comes to education, especially the perspectives that many in the teachers unions hold. And North Carolina is a right to work state. We don't have collective bargaining, so we don't technically have a teachers union, allegedly, but the NCAE says they you know, do union like activity. So,
right.
You know, semantics, but, but when it comes to micro schooling, I just love that people are starting to think out of the box and they're starting to look at education differently. And for so long, we've had this utilitarian, just factory model of education. You know, these are the inputs that we're putting into the kids, these facts, the outputs are their test scores, and measuring success along those lines. And education is just so robust, and it has a lot more, I would say, to do with, I mean, the facts are so important, the three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, those are essential. And if you're not educating your kids in that, you're not doing your job, and the teachers aren't either if they're not doing that. But education is more than just that. It's multifaceted. And so I think that this, what we've all been going through, especially parents and teachers of K-12 students, is sort of rethinking the fundamentals of education. Like, what is really essential? Is it essential that we, meet in person? Is it essential that, you know, we cover this material X, Y, or Z? And I think it's helping us to reprioritize ourselves. It's not without its hiccups. It's not without its difficulties. But I think micro schooling is one of those aspects of this conversation that is sort of moving us back to a one-room schoolhouse approach to education where it's multi-age, which as a homeschool parent, that's something that I've held to for probably a decade now, has been a belief that the one-room schoolhouse approach really does work because it enables the older students to sort of mentor the younger ones. Because I, as a parent of four kids, if I'm homeschooling all four of them at the same time, like if I did each of their schoolwork individually, just one-on-one with me, I would be spending probably about 14 hours a day doing their schoolwork. But when you take the one room schoolhouse approach in micro schooling, blending a couple of families and having a tutor, I mean, you're able to have the older kids work with the younger kids on items while maybe you're giving individual focus and attention to another student that maybe needs help with their algebra problems. So anyways, I just think it's innovative, and it's one of the few good things that is coming out of this drama. So.
Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, my best friend is a teacher. My mom was a teacher for 10 years when I was growing up. When you talk to teachers more and more, they are, like you said, education is not just what they learn academically. It's these other things. And more and more, that's being put on teachers in schools anyway. Like, they're having to be, you know, you see these, I'm a social worker too, and I'm doing this also. And I think that's completely true. I think we're putting a lot of expectations on teachers that, you know, maybe aren't reasonable or should fall to the family or the community or other things. But if you had this kind of alternative model where it's either completely privatized or you have a public option, but students can move, you know, and there's more private schools, that's such against the status quo that, like, a lot of people automatically bristle when they hear that. But if you're a teacher and you start a private school or you go work at a small private school, you know, you can be more in charge. You don't have all these burdensome mandates. Like, there's a lot of benefits, I think, for teachers in that model, but we've just been so conditioned for so long to rebel against, you know, anything that changes the status quo. So yeah, I think Corona is bringing a lot of those shortfalls to life. And you know, you probably know better than, you know, most, so as a homeschool parent, the benefits of taking a more, like, family oriented or small scale, like, approach to your child is not just one of many. Like you said earlier, like, you just put them into the mm-hmm. school. It's kind of an outdated model. Like, you know, the benefits of, like, individualization in education. Right. I think that's becoming, you know, more, the need for that is becoming more clear because of coronavirus, in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we individualize and curate so many other aspects of our lives. I mean, that's why people have fun things in the mail, such as Stitch Fix, which is that outfit service that sends you customized clothing. And there's Birchbox, I think. There's some menfolk ones, too.
I don't know if those are.
Yeah, I don't know them either. My husband's not ordering them, so I have no clue. But I mean, like, we customize so much of every other aspect of our lives. And I really think that this generation of parents that's coming up, millennials and older Gen Z, they're starting to expect this for their kids. And I get so excited thinking about what the future holds on this front. I think there's promise because reform is on the horizon. And I don't think we're calling for an education revolution. I think this is really where there is a semantic issue, which is reform versus revolution. And at Civitas, we've definitely advocated for education reform. We're not saying, and you've even written on this in an op-ed, we're not saying do away with public schools. What we're saying is give families choices, because that enables the parents who believe that their local district school is the best for their child, that they still have that option. While others who maybe believe if their child has different individualized needs, that a private or homeschool is a better option. And so we want those choices for all North Carolina kids. So it's a beautiful thing. Beautiful thing. But yeah. Speaking of choices, one area that North Carolina really limits our choices, and this is our final topic, and beautiful segue again. Our segues are just going so splendidly. is alcohol. So North Carolina has an alcohol monopoly, the ABC store system, Alcohol Beverage Commission. And so, of course, that's happened for years. And our friends at the John Locke Foundation have written extensively about this. So I'm not going to wax on about it, because you can just go to their website and find all sorts of things. But recently, alcohol sale restrictions were instituted here across the state, I think statewide now, where no alcohol sales can be done after 11 p.m. So let's talk a little bit about that. What do you think, Leah? Are you buying your alcohol after 11 p.m. anyways?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the Cooper administration, you know, issued this new rule as part of the coronavirus response. And, you know, from what I've heard, I've only seen clips of the press conference, not the full thing, so I should go back and listen to it. But from what I've heard of their response, it was kind of like, oh, we've seen that you know, restaurants are turning into bars after 11 where they're, you know, no one's really buying food and they're just there for the bars. And as you know, bars in North Carolina are still not open. As of today, bars in North Carolina have not been open since March. But these restaurants that have bars or breweries where those kind of things are open, and Cooper is limiting that to 11. And, you know, for the some of these businesses, most of their sales happen, you know, after 10 o'clock. And so you only have like an hour. And I actually have a family member who's a bartender, you know, relies heavily on tips. Like, how is this going to impact that person and all the people like them out in the state? But yeah, he said that, you know, the reasoning for it, I just thought from what I heard of it, was very shaky. It was like, oh, we know people are doing this. They're at the bars. And we know this is where the cases are coming from, but they didn't actually like say that how they knew that. It was just like kind of more of an assumption. It makes me feel like they've probably just seen a couple pictures of crowded restaurants and, you know, was feeling pressure from their base to do something about it. That's kind of my perception of it.
I think that's the correct perception of it. And it almost seems like that's how a lot of decisions have been made. And I'm not going to fault the Cooper administration for all of their handling of coronavirus. Mm-hmm. These are difficult times.
Yeah.
And so I don't think any of us would have handled it perfectly. And I don't envy leaders that are in the position of trying to decide all this stuff. But boy, oh boy, I feel like there's a lot of, I guess, selective data application.
Right.
In a lot of their decisions. And so sometimes the science says one thing, sometimes they say the science says something else.
Yeah.
And so it just feels very, very subjective when data should not be subjective. It's quite objective. So, yeah, the alcohol sale restrictions, I think it was more just a signal to their base, like you mentioned.
I do too. Because what's the benefit after, you know, all this time of I mean, we're 4 months in, the cases are the numbers are starting to get better, according to Mandy Cohen herself. You know, the trends are starting to head in the right direction. And so to implement it now just seems a little bit like he's just getting pressured to do more about enforcement. And this was a compromise he thought, you know, wouldn't make people too mad, probably. If our listeners would probably be, I'm an avid listener of Pete Callender's podcast. So our listeners, I'm sure, would be interested in him as well. But he was pointing out how, you know, the young people supposedly are causing the uptick in coronavirus cases. And Cooper finds a way to blame this on bars and restaurants instead of talking about the protests that were going on for the whole month of June, which was never called out. But then bars are just and restaurants are being singled out. So I think that's I thought he made a point very well about that. If you guys want to go listen to his episode after this, but. I thought the hypocrisy
we'll put that in the show notes.
Blinding.
Okay, good. Well, yeah, we'll add that to our show notes. And I'll also add the Jeff Bezos speech and some of these other things that we're discussing. We'll go ahead and put those in the show notes as well. But we are out of time. But Leah, this has been a delight to have you on the podcast with me, and we're gonna have to do this again soon.
Yeah, I got some girl power podcasts. It's been really fun.
Woo-hoo. Take that, Ray. No, okay. You guys have a wonderful week. And as always, if you have any questions, comments, or reviews, please feel free to leave them for us on iTunes or shoot us an email at radio@nccivitas.org. You all have a wonderful week.